make sure the right questions get asked and what the answers are going to be. Well, I've been interrogated before. And we had nothing to hide. We just answered his questions. But if you're going to pick leaders, you need people who are willing to at least... I didn't know when I became trustee at large that the KGB was going to get me. Adaptable people. We were at a fellow wrote a book about Alcoholics Anonymous, a Russian that was very pro-AA, Russian doctor. And their procedure over there, because it sold out 50,000 copies immediately, they have a serious alcoholism problem. They were interested. The procedure is, then they have a public meeting. There were 400 or 500 people in this auditorium critiquing the book. Professionals, street people, everybody. And we were invited to come to that. And the fellow who said we will not support AA was there, and he said that on Friday, and this was a Tuesday, and now they were willing to support AA. We found out later what had happened is Mr. Gorbachev said, whatever it is you're doing isn't working. You better find something that does work or you're fired. And we just happened to be in Moscow at the time, so we were invited over. But in that meeting, when we were finally asked to come to the microphone, this question was asked. How do you think, Mr. American, how do you think that Alcoholics Anonymous will work in the Soviet Union? Now there's the hook question. Okay. The response is very simple. I don't know. It would be presumptuous of me to even take a guess. I've only been here 13 days. And that was the right answer. Okay. I'm an AA leader. Okay. I try to set my own opinion aside. And it wasn't just me. This whole team, you'd have been proud of them, set aside personalities and personal agendas in order to be available to the information that had to go out and the people we were going to deal with. That's what you're looking for. When you send a GSR to the assembly, you know there's going to be some hassling going on there. You need to send somebody who can make themselves available to the chaos and not cave in and not set their own fires. Okay? That's not Joel. Let's make him GSR because he hadn't been here for 3 weeks. Don't send him, please, because he'll come back and tell you that's a bunch of shit and you're out of the game. If he goes at all. If you're going to enter service at the trustee level, you must have lots of time, lots of patience, and a high tolerance for pain. Psychic pain, emotional pain, I promise you, if you think as a GSR you're not appreciated, be a trustee someday. You're actively unappreciated. I used to come on to those meetings just beaten battered. Thank God my wife's a nurse. She knows more about the traditions than we do. She had to learn to keep me in line. But there's also a great joy in that kind of thing. The guy who's out front, who goes down the path a little ways first, is the first one to see it happen, to discover. I got to experience what AA was like at the beginning, because I was there at the beginning in the Soviet Union. We got to participate with them. I got a letter back from this one young kid that I sponsored by mail about, I don't know, 8-10 weeks after we'd been there. He said, there's been a division. There was some disagreement with the leadership of the Moscow Beginners Group, so we had to leave it and start 2 more meetings. All it takes is a couple of resentments and a pot of hot tea. This is the kind of thing that Bill used to do. Remember, he went all over the world, took some trips. He sent Eve Marsh around. But that leadership now has had to come to the trustees. This is outside the coat and tie stuff. We have other trustees who went to Mexico. The trustees are responsible for the World Service Meeting. I don't know if you've even heard of it. Every 2 years, any country that has either a publishing operation or its own general service office, because our general service office only serves the United States and Canada. That's all it's supposed to serve. By consensus of the World Service meeting, we are the conduit of information for everybody, but we're not Big Brother. We just have some experience and some great archives, so they've kind of said, okay, you can do that for us. But every 2 years, all of these delegates get together somewhere. Alternating years, it's in New York, and then it's picked from around the country. We've been to what, Munich and Guatemala and New Zealand. Meet for 6 days with only one agenda. It's the only true AA service meeting that exists. It has only one purpose. How can we all better carry the message? It makes no decisions except concerning its own activities. No edicts, no nothing. It's a grand thing to be part of that. At the World Service meeting in New York, as we established our purpose, that our purpose was to meet for 6 days to find better ways to carry the message, one of the delegates from Mexico got up and said, first, I think we better ask ourselves what message is it we're carrying. We set the tone for that meeting, which was incredible, because we really did have to discover what is the message. And then it was my responsibility to come back and tell this little story so that you'll ask yourself the same question. I've been down that road, and now I've come back and asked you to ask yourself, if we're going to carry the message, what message are we carrying? Good question. And that's what leadership does. Goes down the road and comes back and tells you what it found out there. Don't go down that road. There's a 500-pound gorilla down there. I know. I went down that road. Big sumbitch. Oh, that. This thing is real. It's not words on paper. Don't be afraid of leadership. There's a myth in AA that we don't have any leaders. The hell we don't. We better have, and they better be extraordinary people. They don't have to be giants or big eagle things, but they must be extraordinary. Ordinary people are not willing to be interrogated by the KGB. You got to have some lunatic. By the way, just as a sidebar, the interpreter that went with us on that trip will be in Denver next Monday for about 4 or 5 days. Remarkable man. Non-alcoholic, who loves AA enough that he put his own life on the line for us to carry us through this trip. And if anybody in the area would like to meet him, just give me a call. He'd love to see you.
Thank you. All right, do we have any questions or on this concept, Mike?
Good afternoon, Jim. And first, let me preface this by saying this question has nothing to do with my current home group. However, in some groups that I've been part of in the past, there's been the occasional problem of, as you alluded to, people who get voted into trusted positions of trusted servant. Not always just by the AA draft, but sometimes they stand for it. And a few months down the road, they're just not doing the job. And what's some guidance or experience that you may have had with dealing with that situation, since, again, the current set of leadership in my own group is excellent right now. I'm sure at some point, in the future, I'll see that problem arise again. Some experience on handling this sort of problem at the group level.
We've done it right and we've done it wrong. We've been mean-spirited at one point and just kicked them out. Very bad way to go about it. The most successful I've seen, we've only done this twice. One of the fellows got very sick and was simply unable, and everybody loved him and didn't want to hurt his feelings, but eventually we just went and talked with him and said, could we do this? Can we have somebody else doing the work until you get better? And then we can start it over again, because it isn't fair to you or to us And I know it's a drain on you, because you know you want to do it and you can't. And by doing it essentially that way, it worked out fine for everybody. But that's a tough one. But the first tradition clearly makes the statement, the welfare of the group must come first. And so if somebody's not doing the job, the welfare of the group must come first. And we must find a loving way to deal with it, but it has to serve the group.
Hi, I'm Dottie, alcoholic. Would you just tell us a little bit more? This is curiosity, but I'd like to know a little bit more about the non-alcoholic trustees, how we troll for them, where they come from, and why they're doing this, you know? I'd like to, we read a lot about the trustees, okay, we can find out about them, but how about those non-alcoholic trustees?
If you'll come up here next weekend, you'll meet the cream of the crop, and he'll be able to answer that question for you by his very presence. Most of them love us more than we do. The ones I've met, with a few exceptions, are dedicated people. Dr. Jack Norris, giant of a man, stood 4'6". They want Alcoholics Anonymous to go forward. Where do we troll for them? From among our friends. I get around the country a lot, and I meet a lot of these people, and I make those suggestions. And we're constantly recruiting good non-alcoholic trustees. We need their perspective, we need their connections, and we need their guidance quite often. And we also need to educate them. They love AA and want it to go right. We got to tell them what that really means. There's an inclination among non-alcoholics to want to fix things. Well, that's just their nature. And we don't need fixed. We're not broken. We're just screwy. Please, if you get a chance, come up here and meet Jim Estelle. He is the epitome of our Class A trustees. And you want me to get a better answer than just meeting Jim?
Yeah. Juanita, I'm an alcoholic. February 93. One of the things that I've heard a lot here in this group this weekend is how different, diversified, opinionated, and how differently we do things and how much we want everyone to do it our way. And so in so many different groups that we come from, and here we are trying to carry the message. And I heard you loud and clear when you said, if we're going to carry the message, what message are we carrying? So I'd like you to give me a little bit of what you think that message that was discussed, like you said, these, and I'm not as knowledgeable yet, but you just said that there was a particular group that just does that. I mean, they looked at, and that is, of course, essential, because we talked a little bit about, talked with you on one-on-one about how we kill people. We kill alcoholics and we kill non-alcoholics. And I think that's contingent probably on the message that I carry. So can you give us a little bit of...
Yeah, at the World Service meeting, some of the very tangible things are literature. What literature is needed? What's needed in Los Angeles may not be needed in Biloxi, Mississippi, or in Mexico City, or in Sri Lanka. So that's part of the discussions that go on there, is what is appropriate literature. You need to understand, they can write their own literature if they want to. We don't have any locks on that kind of stuff. If they're going to translate our literature, we would like to be involved in that process. Some of the things that came out of that, the AA message is one of recovery from alcoholism, of course. And a lot of discussion was around that. The best description of that is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. What recovery from alcoholism means. One of the reasons AA proliferated from the very beginning was the restoration of family. However you want to look at that, it was the restoration of family that made us world famous. We either put together old families or build new families. That has all kinds of dimension. I'm a member of my community family. I go back to work. I have... The bedevilments are turned upside down, if you will. messages you can live a decent life that makes sense to you. How do we carry that? Well, in the way we walk and talk, and we discussed all that, if I tried to define our message in terms of results, the fellow out in Guadalajara isn't going to hear me, because my outer circumstances are a house and a Dodge Caravan and that kind of thing. He's going to hear that. I have to find a clearer way to describe that. Whatever that means to him, I must communicate the same thing. How do we communicate that? Well, those folks in South America know more about family than we're ever going to know. We got to Guatemala City for that meeting, and every one of us from around the world was met by a group of five or six Guatemalans. The entire AA community became a host committee. They met us, they made sure we were safe and comfortable, because there were still soldiers on the streets with guns in Guatemala City at the time. They took us to their own meetings, but they mainly just hosted us. This one guy was real cute. He said, "I have learned enough English to welcome you." And that's all he knew. That was it. It was over. But he had learned that. Our Japanese delegate learned English because my wife and I were asked to go to Japan for their 15th anniversary. He talked about general service. She learned English so she could host us. Anybody here wanting to do that?
Wow.
Okay. Now, as a result of that, she became the delegate to the World Service meeting from Japan. Lovely lady. We're still in touch. And that meeting, those are the kind of things that get discussed and demonstrated. We begin to see it's more than my little Fort Bragg group or my little Denver group. There's a lot more going on here than I need to learn. What is our message? It's in the literature, it's in the books, but it's mainly in the way we live. And how do I communicate that effectively?
To follow up on that last question, I happen to have spent a considerable period of time sobriety in South Korea and a couple of other Asian countries. One thing I noticed while I was there was that there tended to be two AAs operating in a number of those countries, particularly ones where English wasn't a commonly spoken language. There was the international AA, if you will, which was mostly Americans, Europeans, having their own set of meetings. Most of which are listed in the international directory. And then whatever local AA, was beginning to form. I had a couple of friends in the program who happened to be fluent in Korean and would occasionally attend those. And so there was beginning to be some back and forth in the case of Korea. They also had, just as a way of helping to address this concern, a convention, international convention in Korea, where they had meetings for Koreans as well as the English speaking. I'm just interested if you've seen anything at the World Service level that is addressing that problem. So I've got the impression it's not just in Asia, but throughout the world that kind of a model has developed, and what may be going on to just have more cooperation between the international, English-speaking AA and the more indigenous AAs.
That's not something General Service should ever address, ever. That's up to you and I, entirely.
Okay.
So far, we've held to that. We can share. We went to the Moscow Beginners Group. They'd already been there a year. They were delighted we were there. We learned from them. They learned from us. But their method is, what they do is what they do. We have no input into it whatsoever. It's up to you and I. If we carry any message at all this weekend, if I do, that's the one. That first concept must come to life. We are responsible entirely for whatever is happening or will happen to Alcoholics Anonymous, I am personally responsible. If GSO should, for some reason, shut down, I really won't care. I have 10 extra big books and a big mouth. And a never-ending supply of drunks. And among them is somebody who will insist on handwriting the 11th book. I would just assume GSO didn't shut down, but I'm responsible whether it stays alive or doesn't, and it doesn't matter whether it does or not. The Australians, God, they're fun. The very first thing they did was put their own big book together. You Yanks do it one way, we do it another. And they were very adamant about that. Don't bring that Yankee shit down here. The same book. It's got some Australian stories in it. And they've got this lovely fake leather cover on it. It's a classic book. But we get along with them just fine. We interact just fine.
Others.
What do you say we take about 10 minutes? Just as a point of announcement, it is. Let's get cracked up here, huh, Shelly? Okay, concept 10. Every service responsibility should be matched by an equal service authority. The scope of such authority to be always well defined by tradition, by resolution, by specific job description, or by appropriate charters and bylaws. Most general service positions in the structure, up to and including the delegates, or down to and including the delegates, whichever way you want to look at it, exist by force of tradition. There really isn't anything legally binding a group to have a coffee maker. And most groups by tradition have one. And the scope of that job and the responsibilities that they do is defined generally by each group. But they're pretty common. Make the coffee, get here early, you know, that kind of stuff. And when that don't happen, of course, if we don't give them the resources, say, well, make the coffee, but we don't give them no coffee or a coffee pot or water, well, you know, you ain't going to have no coffee. That's just kind of how the cow ate the cabbage. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff just kind of nuts and bolts stuff, really, when you start looking at it, and, you know, at a level other than from trying to carve it out of these essays. So when you start getting into this business of, like the trustees themselves, they have a legal responsibility, and their job is taken care of through the bylaws, and also it's also a traditional role. So it's at that level or point that you start crossing this invisible line between traditional authority and legal authority. Most of our staff members, in fact, I think now all of our staff members, paid staff members, have a specific job description, and so their authority is and responsibility is pretty well set forth in those job descriptions. We have a charter, charter for the conference. We also have articles of incorporation and bylaws for each of our corporations and the General Service Board, and those deal primarily with a lot of the specifics as it relates to this particular concept. I think Bill basically was just trying to set forth the idea here that in a kind of a general way to say that if you're gonna give somebody authority, a service authority, there is a service responsibility that is the flip side of that coin. And the trick is to try to match it up.
Yeah, this one doesn't even need a whole lot of explanation. But it does need continually redefined sometimes. When I went on the board as trustee at large, the basic job description of trustee at large is here. The job duties were not clear. I came on at a time when things were escalating. One of the things a trustee at large does is if your regional trustee dies or for whatever reason can't serve, the trustee at large will fill in. until the next rotation. It became clear to us with regional forums, which was Dr. Jack Norris's idea. He began to see there was a we-they thing going on in AA. So he helped, he's a non-alcoholic trustee, he helped establish the regional forum, which is simply, since you can't come to the to them, they come to you. Staff members, trustees, hold a weekend while you find out just who they are and what they do, and put faces on the phone numbers that you call from time to time, and make you challenges as needed. Well, it became clear that one of the things the trustee at large could do was attend all regional forums and then report back to the board. It's a two-way street here, because not all the trustees go to those things. So that became part of the job description, that the trustee at large would go to every forum. Lots of discussion about that. There's one extra expense, one extra person. What are we going to do with them when we get them there? All that stuff goes on. Which committees should the trustees serve on? It has to be fairly well defined. A trustee at large should not be on any of the boards. That was pretty clear. Maybe off in Russia somewhere. Maybe off in Texas somewhere when there's a board meeting going on. You need one of the regional trustees who's more at hand for the board. So I never served on any of the corporate boards. I served on the committees. That's really simple. It just all comes from that. Everything's well defined here. If you need those definitions, they're here. But understand they all flex and flow, too.
One of the things we talked about early on in this thing, remember way back in ancient history when we first started this thing? we were going to talk about this group conscience, you know, and how this thing evolved and what it really is. And there's a little bit at the end of this particular concept talks about the difference between the delegated authority and the ultimate authority. The ultimate authority, of course, being the loving God as he expresses himself. Then we start getting into this business of delegated authority, and the truth of the matter is that one cannot exist without the other. So probably if we're having problems with God revealing himself through our group conscience, one of the problems might be that we're improperly using or not matching up responsibility in this business of delegated authority. Are we, in fact, delegating authority and responsibility for people to take care of some things? So this is the kind of stuff that, like Don said, always needs to be looked at. And this is part of the purpose of what a group inventory might help to solve, too. So if there's no questions on this particular one, we'll go on to concept 11 here.
Could you give a more concrete example of what that point?
Well, it's very simply this. For example, if our group is our group a meddling group? Is our group one of these that likes to be lawyering on procedure guides, dot and T's, cross and I's, and all that stuff? Are we one of these that does not trust our trusted servants to handle responsibility for us? Perhaps it's a GSR. Do we believe as a group that we need to send our GSR and two or three corner men to the district meeting to make sure the GSR kind of stands up and tells it like we want to hear? That kind of thing, and it happens. That kind of stuff happens. In other words, we're not delegating really that authority. We've just got some kind of puppet that we've got stringing along down here, and we're instructing them and telling them, you do this, you do that. And the GSR maybe is not a service leader. Maybe they're just a messenger. And the world's full of messengers. So how is God going to reveal himself in a group conscience when that kind of activity is going on? Be a little difficult because it's going to get overwhelmed by the lack of delegated authority. Okay, concept 11.
Do you understand that? One little comment. Right. If we are delegating authority to them, that means we have the authority. Don't be lazy. The only place they get power is from us. And if we don't delegate that to them and tell them what to do with it, shame on us, not shame on them. You got to trust them. You also have to instruct them.
When I was an alcoholic, I won't be too long, and I think it's pretty self-evident, but
When I was a DCM, I went out for coffee. I went to different meetings, and I stand there, and not stand there, but I just say when I shared, I'm the DCM for this part of the district, and if you'd like anything from the district, please come and talk to me after the meeting, and I'd stand some meetings by myself, and that was okay, but I went out for coffee after one meeting, and a couple of the people proceeded to absolutely, like, pull the rug out from underneath my feet, and as far as doing that non-constructive criticism of the district, and these were people who I'd never seen at a district meeting, and I wasn't capable, really, of receiving that criticism at the time. I mean, I didn't do my usual in their face, but I don't know how to shift, so I just started crying. And at the same time, in my mind is starting. I could visually starting to question every person who had ever been of service to me in a service example. Oh, they were just. I mean, it was really psychedelic. But it was, yeah, I know, but, and I know that really the only proper response would have been, and I think I did say, come to the meeting. They never did show up, but there's no way really to address that otherwise, is there? I don't.
You know what a pit rider is?
No.
Any of you that ever rode a bucking horse or anything in a rodeo? There's always in the background behind the cages where they keep the animals, there's always two or three guys walking around with painted on casts and stuff.
Yeah.
And you ask them, you say, what's your story? And they say, well, I got hurt last week, you know, and they never been on a bucking horse ever. They'll tell you how to ride that bucking horse and how to get on the bucking bow and how to rope and how to do it there, and they know it all, but they never done it. See? I call those people pit riders. Concept 11. While the trustees hold final responsibility for AA's World Service Administration, they should always have the assistance of the best possible standing committees, corporate service directors, executive staffs, and consultants. Therefore, the composition of these underlying committees and service boards, the personal qualifications of their members, the manner of their induction into service, the systems of their rotation, the way in which they relate to each other, the special rights and duties of our executives, staffs, and consultants, together with the proper basis for the financial compensation of these special workers, will always be matters for serious care and concern. Sets out the different operating committees of the board, nominating committee, budget and finance, public information committee, literature committee, general policy committee, et cetera. These things go on, and this thing changes a little bit as time goes on. At the actual composition of it, but in my mind, this thing, what I think he's trying to do here is to tie this all together into a nice package, to provide for a continuum of all these things, and to show how they do. The particular importance to me has always been the interrelationship between them, and how they work together towards the ostensibly at least the common good. So. You know, and the essay in this thing just goes on and on and on and on. I'm quite sure Don has some comments on the practical application of it all, at least from that level. I know that this thing was never, or this part of it at least, was never really a bone of contention when I was a delegate to the conference. This thing had been operating for some number of years pretty smoothly most of the time. But I did also recognize that as a delegate, I had a responsibility to be in a kind of an oversight position with respect for this. And so as a result of that, we would have to sit down and take a look at how they were doing it. And we depended a lot at that time on the contributions made by the staff, made by the different service directors that they had at that time. And they would tell us, you know, that if things were going okay or not, and you have to kind of believe that, you know, if they had a problem, they would at least report it. Or make some noise.
So I don't know, Don, do you have some things on this?
Well, I served on the Public Information Committee. I don't know anything about advertising and things like that. So we brought in consultants from radio, from TV, from advertising. They were part of our consultants on that board. We want to do a little public information piece, 1 minute to go out. How do we go about that? I'm now responsible for spending $8 million of your money. I'm just a country boy. I need somebody to tell me, what are the costs going to be here? How do you go about it? How much time is going to be involved in this? I don't know how long it takes to produce a video. Don't have a clue. So we would have consultants come in who knew what the procedures were and could help us wade through that minefield. That was very important. We don't make a decision on the committee as to whether to make a video or not, but we must implement the conference request that we do so, or action that we do so. On the corrections committee, we had people from corrections on the committee. That's a touchy one because each state, each community, each warden has their own autonomy. But there are some basic principles. This is also one of the places we do our recruiting. We bring people like Jim Estill onto the committee as advisors and directors, and they help us. And we get to realize we can use this person in a greater dimension, and they become trustees then. But that's all that is. We are smart enough to know that we're not smart enough to know most of the time. We need some help. And we get them. That PI committee was fun, by the way. This was the most radical bunch of people I've ever seen. They were advertising people. They were lunatics. And some of them were even drunks. Yelling and screaming. And, ow! It was wonderful.
Okay, concept 12. Bet you thought you'd never see this, huh? All right, concept 12. General warranties of the conference. This is the warranties. And these warnings are also contained in the conference charter, too. But
these, by the way, can't be changed. The rest of them can.
Okay. General warnings of the conference. In all its proceedings, the General Service Conference shall observe the spirit of AA tradition, taking care that the conference never becomes the seat of perilous wealth or power. That sufficient operating funds plus an ample reserve be its prudent financial principle, that none of the conference members shall ever be placed in a position of unqualified authority over any of the others. That all important decisions be reached by discussion, vote, whenever possible, by substantial unanimity. That no conference action ever be personally punitive or an incitement to public controversy. That though the conference may act for the service of Alcoholics Anonymous, it shall never perform any acts of government. And that like the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, which it serves, the conference itself will always remain democratic in thought and action. Now, these are the things that Bill, and Dr. Bob Enep sent you to, because this is, the general principles here had already been outlined. But this is what they promised us if we would let them go as the co-founders. And he said that this conference, which if we recall our earlier meeting, was basically an experimental proposition from 1951 to 54. If this conference would be allowed to just go ahead and move forward in this direction, that these are the things that it would never do. And in my experience, and just in the reading of the past actions and everything, it seems like whenever we start kissing the doorknob of coming into compromise with these traditions, that's when the biggest fights occur. And I know that when I was a delegate, 95, which is the one about public controversy, was just, I mean, there was 140-some-odd voting members of that conference that year, and there was 145 ideas about what's a public controversy. And on the one hand, we had a situation in this regard. This actually started out with CHIPS and ended up to be the whole circle and triangle deal. But we had actually initiated litigation at that point against the chip manufacturer, who had refused to honor the cease and desist to stop using the circle and triangle on these chips. And, of course, during discovery, they discovered that we had put a bunch of numbers out regarding, what kind of orders had been submitted by AA groups and blah, blah, blah. And they discovered that they were going to have to produce, for discovery purposes, the names of every GSR
for 10 years from every AA group. And that's obviously an anonymity problem, because this stuff, you know, in the event it would have gone to trial, would have certainly ended up at the public level in the form of, you know, people don't realize, but a lot of court proceedings, in fact, most at the district court level, are public record. Anybody can go in and find them. So we couldn't even, in that particular instance, continue with litigation. And we were stuck. And what we had done by the very fact of filing this lawsuit was we had put Alcoholics Anonymous in a position of a public controversy. And this, because of the fact that this individual who refused to stop manufacturing the chips was an AA member, we had taken an action that was personally punitive. So it was a real sticky wicket, and as has been mentioned earlier, George and I think the conference at that time, and certainly the trustees, found the wherewithal to find a nice way out of this thing. And the conference turned right around and said, and told the board that you must not sue anybody, and we gave them basically a directive that was illegal. And the board kept insisting from the floor, do not make this recommendation. And of course, people were saying, why not? You know, you tell me do not, I'm gonna. And they just wouldn't leave it alone. Well, thankfully, it came up as a floor action, and it was a hung jury. It didn't fly, because enough of the people got the idea that what we were doing was basically telling the board, you're doing something illegal. We were really severely hampering the trustees, because we were putting them in a position of being forced to dilute the corporation. And if we did that, then that's when we discovered, hey, we have no director's insurance.
Oh my God.
On and on, you know, there it goes. But these warranties, and people ask me all the time, that, you know, they want you to be the AA police. We have this member who, blah, blah, blah. We want to kick him out of the group. Can we kick him out of the group? Now, I know another guy that thinks that, yeah, you can kick anybody out of a group. And, you know, I'm not gonna be the arbiter of that particular deal. It says, if you look in this warranty, it says that to get anybody out of AA as a whole would take a three-quarter vote of all the registered groups in the world. Now, I don't know whether that's even possible to do. I don't know how that would even happen. I know there's a procedure in place to do it. But what we would, if we wanted to kick somebody out of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, we'd be having to change one of these warranties. And to change a warranty would require the three-quarters vote of all the registered groups in the world as of the date of the first of the month immediately following the date of the action. So if it was to happen at a conference, it would probably be May 1st. They have 6 months to poll all the groups. How are you even going to find them? And it's got to be three-quarters. It's got to be three-quarters. I don't think it's ever going to happen. Whether or not somebody can boot somebody out of the group, I think that's a group conscience decision, and I think that you got to live with the result of that. Personally, am I in favor of it? No. But I know there's cases where it's happened. So, there's always this big discussion about you can't change the big book. Yes, you can. The only thing you cannot change under these warranties is the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 6 warranties, and Article 12 of the Conference Charter, which in essence is the 6 warranties. Okay? You can change the big book. You can put cartoons in it if you want. It can happen if the conference is willing to do it. And the big book, the first 164 pages is in the public domain. We all know that. We get that. But
never does happen, you know. There's, I would say, a very reasonable assurance it's not going to change much from the third edition as far as the front part. And that's just my feeling on it, and talking to the people that dealt with it and deal with it, and also the reading the conference reports. It just seems like that's the way it's going to be. And I know there's a lot of sentiment in the fellowship to modernize it. When I was delegate, somebody, some area, and I don't even know which one it was, brought up a motion. Now, here's how they come. Make it simpler. Make the big book simpler. You know, the literature community kind of said, well, you know, and one guy got up to the floor and said, what do they want, line drawings? And another guy over there got up and said, it'd probably help. I mean, you can't do anything with a recommendation like that. You talk about general. Make it simpler. Boy, we've all got ideas how to make something simpler, don't we?
If you want line drawings, they're available. The Australian Aborigines put together, for those who couldn't read, drawings about the steps that are probably clearer than anything I've ever seen. They're gorgeous. I've got them. Tommy's got them. We all got them.
Got
my phone number? We'll send them to you. We love them.
I'm Susie, an alcoholic. Serenity date is 1887 from District 20. And an issue that has been coming up in our district at Big Book Studies is, in doing a Big Book Study, is it, a lot of people contend that it's only supposed to be the first 164 pages and not the stories. And I would really like to hear your thoughts and your opinions about that. My opinion is it's all real important, the whole thing, from cover to cover. Thank you.
Whatever they think is important is absolutely correct. That's all that's important to them. When I do a Big Book workshop, we start at the blank page at the front, and we go through the end. We don't go all the way through the stories because people begin to drift away. There are some separate meetings that do that, but we cover, in the first 164 pages, leaves out the doctor's opinion, so we don't leave that out. It leaves out the most important information you're ever going to get out of the Big Book is in the first two sentences of the forward of the first edition. So we don't want to leave any of that out. But if that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. I don't care. Don't worry about it. I don't do it that way.
When I was delegate, we had to handle the pocket Big Book. I'm one of these that I'm always shooting the angle, so I'm thinking, well, I digest come up this thing. We're just trying to get in competition, you know. And then they were trying to decide, well, okay, now if we do it, are we going to leave the stories in? And then they decided, well, because of printing economies and the fact that somebody got up and said, it fits in the pocket of my Levi's just right without the stories.
God,
we're not leaving the stories out. You know, of course, I'm a little impassioned about that. Then they said, well, okay, we'll leave Dr. Bob's name in there. So that's how that ended up to be. And I was in that for a little bit, you know, but that debate, so people use it, you know, what do I know?
That's a whole other discussion if you want to have that one. This is a directive to the trustees to take great care that they never become the seat of perilous wealth and power. They're at the bottom of the triangle. And as a trustee, I took that seriously. We are not to become, because it's easy to do, the seat of perilous wealth and power. How are we going to define that? What is perilous wealth? Because the next warranty addresses what we need is a sound financial policy plus a prudent or an ample reserve to make it a prudent policy. What is an ample reserve for general service? What is that? Now, at the time I was on the board, it was pretty wide open. It was to be... Let's see, how did we have it worded? It was worded wrong since there was no cap on it.
Right.
It could continue to grow, and we thought that was perilous. There was no, if you decided suddenly to start being self-supporting, there was no end to how far that money could go. That concerned us. As trustees, it concerned us. So we put a cap on it. We brought it back, the recommendation, to the conference. We put a cap on it. And what our ample reserve is the amount of the previous year's expenses for all of our operating entities. It can be no more than that. When we reach 94%, I think it is, of that cap, literature prices will begin to come down automatically. Because there's no place to put the money except into that fund. And we are not allowed by our own edict to go over that. We'll stop it. Now, what that means in practical terms is if we all suddenly quit sending money, there was no more money available, nobody bought books, nobody did nothing, GSO could stay open for one full year. AWS could operate, Grapevine could operate for one full year if the money just dried up completely. We consider that an ample, prudent reserve. That we, meaning us, your delegates and the trustees. Okay. Some folks think that's too much, some folks think it's not enough, but that's the current policy. And that right now is what, $12 million, something like that?
No, 11, 11, 6.
It's chump change in the business world. But it's a lot of money to us. Mm-hmm. That's what it takes to operate for one full year. How's that work at home? Okay. If I'm truly self-supporting by my own contribution, I do not want to be in my home the seat of perilous wealth and power. I don't want to be a despot. I don't want to make all the decisions. Okay. And we don't want too much money. My family doesn't know what to do with money, except spend it.
Right.
My wife, thank God I married a sane woman. But I can recall clearly when I went into, one time I went into a little business of my own and got a contract to re-roof all the Denny's restaurants in Arizona. And I didn't have any idea what that meant in terms of finances. I'd done all the numbers. And I went out to my mailbox one morning, and there was $47,000 worth of checks in my mailbox. And it laid around for 3 days because I didn't know what to do with it. That was beyond my comprehension. I finally told my wife about it. She says, oh, put it in the bank. We need advisors. I don't want to make a point. You think that's silly, but that's real. I didn't know what to do with it. And then, of course, we learned. I don't want to be... I'm watching another situation in contrast to what I do. You make your money, you spend your money. It's none of my damn business. Okay? This other party says, I will make all of the money, and I will make all of the decisions. And one of my decisions is any money you make comes to me. That's not uncommon, you know. Well, that's not spiritual. That's not by these principles. I don't want to be the